all stand, please. I respectfully request for the efficient management of business that you give your undivided attention to all matters brought before us. To remain standing, call Bill Self up here to lead us in the pledge of the flag.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
This time I'd like to introduce Harry Van Arsdale, Jr. Harry comes to us as treasurer of the IBEW. Presently, he's the president of the New York City Labor Council, AFL-CIO, financial secretary of local union number 3. Harry?
Mr. Chairman, officers, members of Local 728, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to be here this morning, and I hope in the remarks that I have an opportunity to make that I can have you fully understand the contribution you're making to your local, to the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and to the American labor movement. This meeting today would be an inspiration to many of the trade union leaders that I work with on a day-to-day basis. I was 27 years of age when I became the business manager of Local 3 in New York City. It was a very difficult period, the worst of the Depression, and the membership was about some 5,000. Very few had jobs. The only asset the local union had was the amount of money that those members owed us, because we didn't drop any members during that period for non-payment of dues. We extended credit to them. Now, we built a team in our local, as it's quite evident that you have here, and we got the support of our membership. And we have a great many things that we're very proud of that it wouldn't be time to go into with all of you. We have a loan fund that makes available to a man $10,000 to pay off his mortgage. We have the loan fund that he can borrow money without interest to buy a car. We don't pay the full amount of the car, it's $2,000. We pay the full amount of a cooperative apartment. Any of you that have been in New York know there's no place to live. It's very difficult. The buying of a home. Any of you that are paying our mortgages, you know what you're paying. Now, those things are not brought about easily, but we've had a high degree of cooperation with our employers. We didn't always have that kind of understanding with our employers. When we had when I became the business manager, we had no contract for some period of time. The building trade unions had been forced to accept a reduction in pay. We were forced to accept a reduction 1 year after all the other trades. And as I say, there was no agreement. So from the time I became a business manager, I learned what it meant to have the active support, the day-to-day support of the members and their families to build the organization. And there came a time when some people felt that our local was so far out in front that it was necessary to bring the labor movement in New York City to date. Now, we had always had strong unions in New York City. The early history of the labor movement indicates there had always been strong unions. But there was not a strong labor movement. And when the opportunity came for me to serve as president of the New York City Central Labor Council, the membership voted that I should give as much time as necessary to that post. And I informed the membership before they voted, with some 3,000 at the meeting, that it would take all of my time. Now, I have a great many titles, but at present I accept only one salary. That's all I ever accepted in years gone by. But the things are intertwined, and one helps the other a great deal. In our Central Labor Council, we now have 1,200,000 men and women that comprise the membership of our affiliated locals. 300,000 of those men are black and Spanish-speaking, and they play a very important role in our labor movement in New York City, and they serve in every capacity on the committees as well as on the executive board and the top offices. Our Central Labor Council, for the first time in the history of our state, brought about a condition where we were able to recommend a trade union leader from our ranks to become the industrial commissioner. We had some great governors, but we never had an industrial commissioner that came from the ranks of labor. Last night, we had a meeting in Madison Square Garden to honor our members that have become 60 years of age. With 20 years of membership, there's some 1,400 or 1,500 of the names listed here because it was the first time we had one in 4 years. We customarily in the past had them every 2 years. The first one in 1939, and this last night was the 16th. And we're very happy at the fact for these years that when a man became 60 years of age and 20 years of membership, from then on he paid no more dues or insurance or pension. But that cannot be done unless arrangements are made to accumulate a fund for that purpose. His dues are paid and his assessments and insurance and pension are paid, but it's paid from that fund rather than by himself, and that goes for the member of every division of our organization. Now, this is very exciting to me, what you're doing, because it comes at a very vital and important time. The growth of the organized labor movement has been stymied. It's been brought practically to a halt. If you study the membership for the last, since the passage of the Taft-Hartley law, you will find that the growth of the labor movement in our country has stopped. We had 27 of the leaders of our Canadian locals at our educational center in Bayberry, Long Island, in Southampton. That's our educational center for our members. We set aside a week. They tell us that they have 37% of the workforce organized in Canada. In this country, we have less than 25% of the workforce organized. And as you organize your local and as you make giant steps forward, you'll realize that it's also necessary to see that the rest of the labor movement is organized. If not, it'll pull you down or it'll slow you down from attaining your goals. Now, I start to say we had a high degree of cooperation with our employers. Cooperation, I understand there's a number of your employers here, and I'm very happy they are. But I'd like to suggest to them that cooperation is not a word to be used carelessly or recklessly. If an employer is going to cooperate with a union, the union has many vital problems. The workers, the members have many vital problems. And if the employer comes to understand them fully and shows a sympathetic understanding of those problems and helps to find the solutions for the men, our experience is that those men will respond by giving those employers every kind of support that they're entitled to. No union man has a right to make it difficult for a union employer that's living up to the kind of a contract that you have and turn his back on the fact that other employers are actively undermining that employer's business because he has access to lower labor costs. So it's a two-way street. And in some parts of the country, I'm sorry to say, there are some employers and some employers' representatives that do not fully recognize the two-way responsibility that exists. It's just as important that the officers and members of a local union recognize that two-way responsibility. Now, in New York City, the organization of hospital workers which was so low paid, it was not only a disgrace to the labor movement, it was a disgrace to America. And these conditions still exist in many places. The tremendous growth of the organization of the teachers, the organization of college professors. We put a team together in the Central Labor Council and went out to undertake to do a similar job to what had been done by a similar team of dedicated and conscientious members in our local union. We have a situation in New York is very serious to contend with. We have racket unions that couldn't exist without the Taft-Hartley law and the Landon Griffin law. The National Labor Relations Board, an agency of our United States government, tells us that the racket union has the same rights before their board as we do. Well, that's a strange situation. You take a racketeer that poses as a union official and negotiates a contract with an unscrupulous employer. They're the only two in the room. How can you get proof that that's an illegal activity? Our Central Labor Council put a drive on these characters. Great many of those kind of employers moved out of our city and went up and filled empty factories up in the Yonkers and Westchester area. They went to court. They were bold and brazen enough to go into court and bring cases against our affiliated unions. They even had the gall to sue some of our affiliated unions because our unions went to the members in the plants and told them they were being victimized, some of them only getting 5 or 10 cents above a minimum wage after years of service and hard work. And they immediately responded and closed ranks. The overwhelming majority of these workers were black and Spanish-speaking, but they closed ranks and they supported our labor movement. And we found we were stymied because of our Supreme Court in the state, which said that our way of life is built on contracts and agreements, and that the court had to uphold the agreement. They had to restrain us from bringing a bona fide union to the workers. We asked the court, look at the wage scales these people are receiving, and that'll tell you whether or not it's a racket union. The courts felt that that wasn't sufficient proof. We asked them, how do you gather sufficient proof? We took this up with the prosecuting agencies in every borough. We took it up with the state authorities. We took it up with the federal authorities. We took it up with our senators. The condition isn't anywhere near as bad as it was. But it's still the fact that it exists to any degree at this time is still a very serious one for workers and for sincere employers that live up to some agreed standards. Now, in our labor movement, there are some of our unions that have been more successful than others. There are members of our unions that have been more successful than others. We have to guard against the fact that selfishness is a very serious and detrimental thing in an organization of workers. If one individual is going to exercise selfishness and only consider his own individual interest, it's very difficult, makes it difficult for that organization to move forward. Now, lots of times, I think anyone would agree that no one has a great tremendous admiration for a selfish individual that thinks only of himself. But some of us don't realize that our organization at times can act selfishly. And we all come to the defense of our organization. And it certainly doesn't apply in this local union or in most cases in the IBEW. But in some unions and in some cases in our own organizations, it does exist. And it's something for us to be on guard. Recognize if we're acting collectively in a selfish manner and overcome it. And we have a slogan that we've had for a great many years, help those less fortunate. And if we as an organization proceed on the basis of helping those less fortunate, we'll hold to a minimum the selfishness that exists in an organization. Now, in our Central Labor Council, which is made up of all the responsible leaders that can make the decisions, that doesn't exist in all Central Labor Councils or state federations, it's very vital in our opinion. Charles Garahan, a vice president of the Amalgamated Clothing Workers, reported to us a condition that existed in El Paso, Texas. A strike of what a non-union company that had grown to be the largest manufacturer of pants and slacks. There's a great many slacks used and sold in this area. I was attending a progress meeting of the IBEW in El Paso, Texas, shortly after that report, and it dawned on me, I'm in the city that Charlie Garahan reported on that strike. I got out to that strike. And what I witnessed is something that the entire labor movement better become aroused about. And we better do something about it. Here were 3,000 workers, mostly Mexican-Americans, on strike. That strike now is going into its 6th month at the present time. I went out to the plant. You'd think it was a plant of the General Motors. You'd think it was a plant of the Ford factory. I spoke to the people on the various entrances to those picket lines. I spoke to a young Mexican-American that was the first worker to sign a card for a union. He was the first one to be fired. He won his case and got some of the lost wages through the National Labor Relations Board after tremendous delay. He told me he had 8 children. I told him how much I appreciated meeting a man like him, and that I'd go back to my city and make our Central Labor Council more aware than they were of that strike. Our Central Labor Council immediately made it one of our top priorities. Now, do you think we don't have enough problems in New York City to keep us busy without involving ourselves in that kind of a dispute? We recognized that this was the same kind of a dispute as we had in Greenpoint in 1940. Where our local union had close to 2,000 men and women out on strike for 11 and a half months before they could win a union. And our members saw to it that those workers had some money every week that they were on strike. And that's organization, that's brotherhood, such as you're demonstrating here today. And it's got to be done. The hospital situation was impossible when we faced up to it. The Farrar strike is very similar. That union's paying 3,000 workers $30 a week. It's not enough for the workers. But very few unions can afford to keep that going on for 6 months. The union didn't want this strike. The union was organizing. They were there for 2 years. This company forced this strike. So anything that your organization or anything that you or your friends or your family can do, and if you can arouse the other associated or affiliated unions, the American labor movement must beat Farrar, not just the 3,000 Mexican-American workers that are trying to help the 6,000 that are walking past their picket line. Now, how could this develop in this country? How could they become the largest, the biggest in the world? It's because our union members have been buying those non-union products for all of these years while that company was growing from a small company to the largest. They have so much funds and they're so powerful that one of their representatives of that company made a statement that was reported in the Washington Post that they could keep the case going 4 or 5 years in the courts. Well, our Central Labor Council has moved with the Senate Labor Committee and the Labor Committee of the House of Representatives that we want to know, are they going to do something about that? We hear all the speeches when there's elections and campaigns. When there's problems like this, we don't want their sympathy and their understanding. We want some action from the Congress about the fact that any employer could have such control that more than 800 workers, more than 800 of those workers, American citizens, have been arrested for standing closer than 50 feet to each other on a picket line. And each one of them was held in $400 bail. And not one of them has had a hearing. Now, if that can happen in Texas or any other part of the United States, then every trade unionist in this country better take it as a personal affront and be prepared to do something about it. Because in helping the Farrar workers, we're strengthening our New York City Central Labor Council. And when your organization embarks on the program that you're involved in, to bring organization to everyone in every branch of the electrical trade in your jurisdiction, you're making a tremendous contribution. You're setting an example. You're inspiring a lot of people to think or are falling for the propaganda that the American workers aren't supporting the labor movement. The American workers would be stupid if they didn't support the American labor movement when they have a full opportunity to do it. Because we live in a highly organized society. The bankers are well organized. The insurance companies are well organized. All of the giant monopolies are well organized. They're so well organized that they have formed multinational corporations. And they've exported a million of our jobs, many of them highly skilled jobs, to the lowest wage areas in the world. The workers in Japan, as a result of so many committees visiting our labor movement, our country, and so many of our labor representatives and union members visiting Japan on official visits, the Japanese workers have raised their standards to the extent that they're complaining about the low-wage areas in other parts of the world. Now, we were subjected to great propaganda about the low wages of Japanese workers, but nobody ever told us, nobody ever informed our labor movement that fringe benefits for Japanese workers amount to 100 or 125% of their wages. Nobody went into detail to tell us that when a Japanese worker went to work, his employer was required to keep him, whether he had employment, whether he had work, or what he had. He was required to keep him. It was a responsibility of the employer to keep him at work. So now they're undermining whatever standards those Japanese workers had. So we need to face this situation, multinational unions. Now how can we make a success of multinational unions to meet the challenge of multinational corporations if we don't do what you're doing here this morning? If we don't organize every worker that has the good sense to join with us and have the benefits for his members of his family, like those that have been in unions have received. And any union that adopts a policy that they're satisfied to have 200 workers, 200 members, and have 1,000 or 2,000 people working for 10 or 15 years, any union's responsible in any way for an electrical worker to be entitled to a pension from the NEBF without ever having belonged to a local of the IBEW. That's not trade unionism. That's selfishness at work. That's short-sightedness at work. That's stupidity at work. And your local is setting an example to overcome that. Now, we had your vice president to our last meeting of our union. We had our vice president. But the meeting prior to that, we had J.P. Pate, and he made a terrific hit with our members in describing the accomplishments and the problems that exist in the area that he has responsibility for as a vice president of the IBEW. And the best proof of the impression he made was that when I was coming here, a number of the members said, find out when Vice President Pate is coming back and visit us again. We have a program that our president, Charles Pollard, who in my opinion is the came into the presidency of the IBEW as the right man in the right job at the right time. And President Pollard is having more and more responsibilities placed on his shoulders to carry on and help the American Federation of Labor, CIO, solve some of their problems. And it's normal and it's natural in the labor movement. Whoever's willing to work gets it. They get plenty of it because we got some fellas that think when they get to a high office that it's time to relax, to rest. The job can never be done. I don't care how much a man has accomplished. He can't make his full contribution to the American labor movement till they put the cover on his coffin, whether he's in office or out of office. Because the work has to go on, whether you're an official or whether you're a former official. The experience that a man has that has served and has gotten results can be very helpful. But we're fortunate in counting our blessings to be part of the IBEW. Some trades, some unions, some industry are going downhill. You have them on the buildings. Substitutes are eliminating them. The electrical workers got a tremendous field ahead of them, but you can only get the full returns of that opportunity through organization. All you have to do is follow the example of everyone that's successful, every corporation. They're highly organized as corporations, and they're highly organized as organizations of corporations. A worker in a worker's organization has a very difficult time coping with them to get a degree of justice. Without organization, he has no chance whatsoever as an individual. Some fellow might be able to get along for a short time, think he's doing great. Suppose he meets with an accident and he's alone with no brother members to be helpful to him, with no funds in an industry to provide for him. So the fellow who thinks he can get along, and there are some men that can, they ought to be given to realize that it's a responsibility they have to help others that might not have all of their outstanding qualifications in their own opinion. Now, organization is not an easy thing. It needs the active day-to-day support of the members of the organization. The members of the organization should undertake to be well-informed and to study the various aspects of the problem, because there are many times members can step into a situation and be helpful in a way that the paid officials cannot be, or the part-time officials cannot be. And when members have an understanding of the seriousness of the problem, I've never had the experience in our union or in the Central Labor Council that they don't respond. Now, we are subjected to great propaganda, and this is one of the things our members and their families must understand. It's surprising that the labor movement is able to hold as much ground as they have. Our people, our members, are subject to the propaganda of the news media in the morning, during the day, and when they sit down to relax after a hard day's work, they're subject to the propaganda. I say to the representatives of the news media and the representatives of these various corporations that I have occasion to serve with in public functions, I say to them, how much do you know of the aims and aspirations of the American labor movement? I had occasion with a committee of our Central Labor Council to go before the Board of Higher Education. Now, they're a group of people that consider they're making a great contribution, and they have been in our city. And they're proud of what they're doing. And I had occasion with our committee to say to them, you ladies and gentlemen are ignorant. You're the representatives of the Board of Higher Education. I say to you, you're ignorant. You're ignorant of what the aims and aspirations of the New York City Central Labor Council and its affiliated unions are attempting to do
for their 1,200,000 workers and for the 200,000 low-paid workers that go to work every day and don't get as much as they could on welfare. And one fellow resented it. He said, "Well, Mr. Menazzo, it's very easy for you to come here and tell us we're ignorant." He says, "But if the Central Labor Council would give us their full support when we need funds, when we need appropriations," he says, "we'd be able to do a great many things that we haven't been able to do." I said, "Sir, you're more ignorant than the other members of the Board of Higher Education." And the chairman had to tell him, please, Mr. Menazdale's organization has supported the Board of Higher Education actively and vigorously in every one of our activities." Now, I didn't say that to insult those people. I did it to spur them on, to have them realize, because I said, it's easy to understand why you're not familiar with things as they are. You have to depend on the news media. Now, if any one of you wants to test this, you stand on any corner and ask the first 25 people to come along. Could you give me the name of a corrupt labor leader? And I'll bet you 20 out of the 25 could give you the name of a corrupt labor leader or someone that they've been led to believe is a corrupt labor leader. Then say to the next 25 people, could you give me the name of a corrupt head of a bank or head of an insurance company? Think about it yourself. Ask yourself. Ask your family. Can you think of the name of someone that has betrayed the confidence that workers put in them? And then ask yourself, can you think of the head of a corporation that has pleaded guilty or been found guilty of dishonesty? If you ask me that question, I can't tell you the president of top management official of a bank or an insurance company in the last 2 years. I could give you some names of previous ones. Do you think that means there aren't any? It means that the news media has pounded into our heads the scoundrels, the few scoundrels out of the 60,000 locals throughout the United States and Canada. And they've made the most of it. Because we've had a few scoundrels, we got Taft Hartley laws. And then when we got some new scoundrels, we got Landrum Griffin. But they would have liked to give us those kind of laws and worse, without us having one scoundrel. But they used those as a vehicle to weaken our march of progress. Now, to give you an illustration, the former secretary of the AFL-CIO, William Schnitzler, he was a baker. He was a representative of the bakers local in Newark, and then of the international, Newark, New Jersey. He put together a brief which showed conclusively that when they have scandals in pension funds and welfare funds, they pass laws, and the federal government specified which companies could be the bonding companies for those representatives of unions or employers that served as trustees of pension funds or welfare funds. The reason they stipulated which companies you had to be bonded with was they were fearful that some union, some international union, might buy their own bonding company and carry on in the same fashion that they were accused of doing. Those bonding companies charged higher figures, higher commissions, higher premiums to bond union officials. Now, as they thought, they were coming into something where they thought everybody was a scoundrel. But as time went on, Mr. Schnitzler's brief shows conclusively that they had less losses bonding the union members, or the union officers of union funds and union. They had less losses. They reduced their premiums drastically. They didn't give back the excess that they charged starting out, but they reduced the premiums. And Mr. Schnitzler had a long list of names of people in financial institutions that had pleaded guilty and were found guilty of manipulating the funds. and of stealing money. And the bonding company's losses proportionally were much greater. Now these are things that come to us as a surprise. It was a surprise to me when I first heard former Secretary Schnitzler make that presentation. It's because our news media is not giving the people in this country the true story of what the American labor movement, the members and their elected officials and representatives, what they're contributing to this country. Now, why don't they give the full story? If you owned a newspaper, if you owned a radio station, if you were one of the owners of a broadcast TV corporation, how could you function? Could you function without advertising? Now, if a newspaper can't function without advertising, if a radio station can't advertise without advertising, if the TV can't function without advertising, where do they get the advertising? They get it from the corporations in this country. A lot of them monopolies, some legal monopolies. They get it because of those corporations. And those corporations aren't spending their money in supporting newspapers and radio and TV to really give the American people, to really have the American people understand what has made this nation great. It hasn't been selfish corporations, multinational corporations that have exported a million jobs out of this country and contributed to the unemployment that we shouldn't have. Now, if you give a little thought to these things, you'll quickly realize what an organization is up against. Years ago, one of the most important and interesting things you could do is take time to read the history, if you haven't done so, the early history of American labor. Men were killed, lost their lives. It's still happening. One of the hospital workers was murdered in Philadelphia a month ago. So it's still going on, but it happened at a much greater rate when organizations were first being formed. I have the benefit of other men's tremendous sacrifices. I was born during a lockout of electricians in New York City that lasted 33 months from 1904 to 1907. I was born during that. 1,800 electricians were locked out, and 400 stuck it out for 33 months. Just try to visualize that. You say it couldn't happen today. There are some people at work that would like to bring back those kind of conditions, if they could. Now, that wasn't good for our city. That wasn't good for our country. That wasn't good for those electricians and their families. So I grew up understanding the injustice of these things. And I want to spend every day that I have left on this earth helping people like you to understand the injustice that exists. When there's a strike, when there's turmoil, when there's a lockout, everybody can see that. But what the officers of your local union and what the officers of our international brotherhood are up against, the same kind of a situation exists. But they're a little more clever in the kind of weapons they use to turn you back, to hold you down. And they do it in a good spirit. They figure the American worker is too well off. The American worker is too prosperous. The American worker is not producing the way he should. And the only way to have him do that is to create 5 or 6 million people being unemployed. Now we have some responsibility in this kind of a situation. We came close to having a full employment economy. Our Central Labor Council has been fighting one of the things for 10 years for a full employment economy. And we say that if we're not going to get a full employment economy and if there's going to be millions out of work, we're going to reduce our hours. And we're going to keep reducing our hours. And we're going to do that until such time as we have a full employment economy. And there's more locals in our Central Labor Council that have a 6 or 7 hour day and one with a 5 hour day. There's more locals like that in our central body proportionately than there is in any other part of the United States. It's costing you as taxpayers, and you're paying out of all proportion the percentage of taxes that you should be expected to pay. Unemployment is costing all of us $600 billion. Some people say, did you mean million? No, the figure is $600 billion. That all of us are losing in goods and services in every five-year period. And you don't have to be a great economist to figure it out. You can be just a fellow that went to school for a little while. If there's 5 million people unemployed, and if they would have averaged $3,000, if they would have averaged $5,000 a year, which is not a great sum of money, because we had all the engineers from the aerospace were fired by the hundreds and the thousands, some of them making as high as $40,000 a year, and they just didn't know where to turn. They were as seriously affected as a low-wage worker that finds himself unemployed. But if you take 5 or 6 million workers, and if they earn $5,000 a year, average, high and low, I think it comes out 30 million or 25 million, 25 billion dollars. Now, if that's the labor, and the labor represented 25%, that would be $120 billion a year in goods and services. And in a five-year period, which is a very short time in the history of a country, that's $600 billion in goods and services. So we ought to have a full employment economy. Our responsibility is that when we got the closest to a full employment economy, it appeared, because of the news media again, we can have 20 strikes in New York, or 20 potential strikes, we can successfully avoid 18 of them without a loss of a day's pay, and the two that we can't find the solution to gets nationwide publicity, makes it look like people are on strike all the time. But if during that period a great many unions called strikes, and then it appeared that every time that a settlement was proposed, the members voted the settlement down, it was exposed that a great many of the members were working other places and didn't care whether it was settled or not. These are not good things for us. And it also appeared that every individual that didn't belong to an organization was making demands from his employer, and if he didn't get them, he went someplace else. So these are the kind of things that create the kind of thinking among those who run the country that we've got to have millions out of work so that they won't do these things. And it hasn't been going on to the same extent. So I think that when you understand these things, and if labor accepted its responsibilities, as I'm sure they would, if they knew there was a sincere effort being made to establish a full employment economy, as we would get closer and closer and closer, we would limit our having strikes, even though they're exaggerated by the news media. We would limit them wherever possible. Never give up the right to withhold our labor. When you can't withhold your labor, you're pretty much of a slave, no matter how much you get paid. Always have the right to withhold it, but don't unnecessarily exercise that right. So last should be a last resort. Now, I could talk to you when you wouldn't be able to see the picture and you wouldn't get this meeting over. But I want to say in closing that I congratulate you. I know when Brother Pate reports this meeting to our international president, Charles Ballard, and to our longtime international secretary, Joe Keenan, when they get the impact of this meeting, this is going to make them realize that what a great many people are telling them can't be done, can be done. And your local is proving it can be done. And you have, as members, and your offices are proving it can be done. And if it could be done all over the United States and Canada, quickly, Charles Ballard's program for progress that he presented to us at the convention in Seattle could become a reality much quicker than it will otherwise become a reality. Now, One thing I'd like to bring to your attention in closing, there's a great deal of propaganda. Young people are not taking any interest in the American labor movement. You're giving the lie to that. The young men in this audience that are here are giving the lie to that kind of propaganda. Women are not interested in the labor movement. They just become members if they get a job where there's a contract and they gotta have a checkoff. And the minorities, the black and Spanish speaking, they don't support the labor movement. And the labor movement has just become a lot of old timers that like to talk about what happened 50 years ago. And nobody wants to listen to that, and justly so. Now we undertook to prove that to be a lie. A lie that if it was allowed to spread would damage our interests. So in our last parade in New York City, we got across to our affiliated locals. We got across to them that we're going to have the parade. You've always supported the parade. You've given it all out support. This time we want to ask you to do something special. If you have women members, we want you to make a special effort to have them actively participate on your committee and in the parade. We want you to have your black and Spanish-speaking members actively participate on the committee and in the parade. We would appreciate you having your young members come out and actively participate. It's propaganda, young members. If young men didn't come into the labor movement for the last 10 or 15 years, we'd have no labor movement. We have to have the young people come in. And we have to have them understand the tremendous contribution that they can make. Well, the turnout in that parade, watching those hundreds of thousands of people go by the stand, proved conclusively that this is bunk, this is propaganda. Our black and Spanish people turned out in that parade in such tremendous numbers. Our young people turned out in such tremendous numbers. Our women members turned out. A lot of people thought, oh, you can't have a Labor Day parade. It's a three-day weekend, and the workers are all on their own boats, and they're all golfing, and they're all fishing, and they're at their summer cottages, which is great. That's what's made America great. And there's nothing wrong with it, and we want a great deal more of it. We want it for those who haven't had it yet. But proved the lie of that propaganda. That parade went on till 10:30 at night. Started at 12 and went on till 10:30. And in that parade, there's always a problem in a tremendous parade of that kind. Who's going to be first? We don't want our union to be last. We were last time, and it was so late a lot of our members got discouraged. Well, we had the electrical workers march last in the last parade to show there's no favoritism, and there should be no favoritism. So the electrical workers, well, at 10:30, they had to carry their flashlights, and they had other electrical things to show they didn't let the dark overwhelm them. The electricians bring light to the world, and that's what you're doing here today. I'd like to come back there sometime. We have no place to go and talk to you for a whole day. So long, keep up your good work.
This time we've got our man, friend of mine, speak to us. I've known since...